Okay, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to start the next session. If you'd like to return to your seats or head off to the film screening. My name's Roger Lewis. I'm chairman of the St. John's Society, which is the other registered civic community association in Brockley Ward, covering the northern part of our ward. Our next topic today is debt, money and exploitation, which is obviously a very prominent theme in popular discourse at the moment, following on from the crash, which was obviously in 2007-08. I think it's been the view of the organising committee as we've been talking through this topic that some of the core ideas behind why the financial crisis happened, what could be done about it, I know it's a cliche, but the lessons learned seem to have dropped off the radar a little bit as the national debate has focused towards the debate over austerity and whether it should be continued or curtailed. We have a wonderful lineup of speakers. We're going to start with Ravi Ravindram, who is Chief Executive Officer of Lewisham Plus Credit Union. Lewisham Plus Credit Union has over 11,000 members in Lewisham and Bromley and 1,600 juniors. Next up will be Ivo Mosley, who lives in St. John's. Ivo is an author of fiction, plays and cultural criticism for many publications, both mainstream and fringe. His most recent book is entitled In the Name of the People. Helen Mercer, another Brockley resident. Helen is a recently retired senior lecturer in economics at Greenwich University and a founding member of Drop NHS Debt, People versus PFI, People versus Barts PFI, Save Lewisham Hostel Campaign, and Lewisham Keep Our NHS Public. I think that's a wonderful list of campaign activities, and I think Brockley is fortunate to have her as a resident. Finally, Sean Williams, who is from the Toynbee Hall, which was founded by Arnold Toynbee, I think, who was a 19th century economist committed to... Actually, I think it was named after him. It wasn't founded by him. It was named after him because he died tragically young. Sean, after a 15-year career as a diplomat, Sean joined the staff at Toynbee Hall, a charity committed to ending poverty. Her vision is a UK in which every organisation, whether government, business or third sector, takes responsibility to ensure that they have a positive impact on people's financial health. So without further ado, we will continue, and if I'd like to invite Ravi to talk.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I hope this session proves less controversial than the last one. This is my personal view of mine. I've ignored any systemic issues like unemployment, homelessness. I've also assumed the rent is covered and has some kind of income in my assessment of combating debt. So why do we get into debt? The area I'm going to cover is why do we get into debt, the types of debt, and how do you manage it or avoid it, and about future generations and how they can hopefully avoid it. So, can I have a show of hands? Who's worried about debt here? Not that many. Okay. Who thinks debt is just bad, full stop? Okay. All right, interesting. Reality is debt is everywhere. Governments, councils, corporations, people, everyone borrows at some stage in their life. To put things in perspective, globally speaking, USA has 20 trillion in debt. That's trillion. UK has three, this is dollar terms. UK has 3 trillion and Japan 4 trillion in debt. As a percentage of GDP, Japan's debt is 235% of their GDP, followed by Greece at 182%, and followed by Italy, and then Canada at 98.8%, and UK at about 92%. Let's take it down a level, focusing on the UK. People in the UK owe about £1.6 trillion this time. It went up about 7% in the last 5 years. Mortgages make up about £1.35 trillion. Student debt, about £100 billion. Cars, £31.7 billion. And the consumer debt in general is £200 billion, up in the last 5 years by nearly 20%. Out of that, credit cards make up $70 billion, and we spend $30 billion a year on takeaway foods, $3.5 billion on coffee. So average total debt in the UK per household is 57,500, about 30,000 per person. I hope you agree this is really horrendous statistics. And I'm hoping today I'm going to try and help adjust your lifestyles to improve how we can go forward. So what do we get into debt? As a nation or as individuals, I think there are three main reasons. This is a personal view, I must say. Instant gratification, so we want things now. Ego, competition with the neighbours or other people. And in some cases, addiction. So the main reason for getting into debt quicker, to get things done quicker or faster, we have to wait to save money. But if we have to wait a long time to save money, but in some cases, we're not willing to do that, and if we find somebody who is willing to help us lend money to us, then we can get these results quicker. So people tend to borrow and then find that they can't afford to repay the debt. Apart from that, ego. So put it another way, keeping up with the neighbours. You know, your son or daughter wants something and you need to buy it, and you need to buy it now to keep the peace in the house, that kind of thing. So we kind of go into that area because of peer pressure and other pressures from home. And the other third reason is addiction, addiction to alcohol or substance abuse, but I won't go into much details here about that. So in my view, there's nothing wrong with getting into debt as long as we do it for the right reason. There are some debts that are good, and some bad, and some downright ugly. We're going to talk about the ugly debts first. So if we need money, there are various places we can go to, and some people tend to go to unsuitable lenders, like loan sharks, or the likes of Wonga or Satsuma, where if you borrow £100 today, over a year, you end up paying 1,800 in some cases. So it's 1,700% interest. Okay? So this is, once you're in there, it's very difficult to get out. And it's a cycle that repeats itself, and then you find yourself out in the streets. A bad debt, in my view, is purchasing something like a brand new car on hire purchase or finance, or going into borrowing money to go on a holiday or a celebration, which you're not prepared to wait or save to. So that again, not totally necessary, but inevitably you're pushed into it, so you go for it. So what's a good debt? If you borrow to invest, either in yourselves or someone close to you, a business or a house, I think, or start a business, something like that, I think that is a good debt. But then again, it should be affordable and manageable by you, by your income. So what I have actually talked about so far is about debt, but there is the other side of the coin, which is far important activity in our lives, which is savings. The only real way to combat debt properly is not to borrow at all. Always use funds that have been saved in anticipation of the expected expenses and the unexpected. So, can this be done? I think it can. You may differ. Your views might be different. So, what needs to be done? Advanced planning, setting budgets, changing behavior, early education. I think they are the key ingredients to make it happen. When we are born, we need to have any debt. And in most cases, we do not have any debt until by adulthood. By contrast, we start getting paid the minute we are born. I don't know if you know, it's called child benefit. If the child benefit is saved up, it's about 90 quid for a month. If it's saved up and a growth rate of about 4%, by the time the child is 18, the nest egg would be £40,000. That's really quite a lot of money. When you're 18 and you've got 40 grand, you have endless possibilities. You could, you know, go to university, come out without any debt. You could start a business. Okay. Start a business. You know, all sorts of things. So I'll give you another example, another couple of examples before go on to this topic. So if you avoid takeaway food, for example, coffee or bottled water. I mean, we never had bottled water about 15 years ago. That industry is worth about $4 billion. So all the money is going to somebody else's profit pockets. So if you avoid that, I'm sure each and every one of us could save about £100 a month. And again, if you put it away, in a few years' time, you'll have a substantial amount of money. Sorry, I've been asked to cut down. One of the other reasons why we also have quite a lot of debt in this country is often we say, let's put it on the plastic. It's kind of some kind of hidden wallet that's never going to come back to bother you. And this carries on and you mount up the debt and suddenly you find yourself you can't cope. In corporate terms, it's called off-balance sheet financing. I don't know if you heard about a company called Enron that went bust a few years ago in the US. So off-balance sheet financing is if you're running a project, you're doing something that is not your normal business, you put it on the off-balance sheet, take it off the balance sheet. And then when the project is finished, then you bring it back. So I think we are all kind of doing off-balance sheet financing when we put it on the credit card and think it's not going to bother us. But believe me, it'll come back. So you've done everything to kind of handle your debt and still not finding an answer for that. So what would you have to do? You should really seek advice very quickly and urgently. Step Change, for example, is a good not-for-profit organization. CAP, Christians Against Poverty, also helps people. There are many online debt advice and money advice places you can go to. You could go to your local credit union. Sorry, I'm not plugging my own business, but I think it is a good place to go to if you need help. Here I have only spoken about individuals and how they should be able to manage. But there are other things people could do. Councils, governments. Why is Wonga allowed to charge 1,700% in this country? Why can't they do something about it? Why are councils giving planning permission to money shops? You know, people who create debt in the community. You should lobby, you should argue, you should go to the council meeting, and you should say, it shouldn't happen. Not done. Okay. Right, just one thing before I go. Education for future generation is a key in combating debt, in my opinion. In primary schools, we don't cover that anymore. No financial education in primary schools. If we do that, then things will be a lot better for us in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ravi. That was fantastic. Very interesting themes there. I think an author called Stephen Armstrong, who's a Guardian journalist, wrote a book called, he retraced George Orwell's steps to Wigan, a book called The Road to Wigan Pier Revisited. And in that book, he sort of says that lending to and supporting people on very low incomes is actually a very big business. It's very, very highly profitable with far higher returns than lending to people who are more comfortable. Ivo, I'll pass over to you.
Right, so this talk is about the process that underlies a lot of things we're talking about now, unaffordability of homes, debt, many of the other bad things. And it's a little bit complicated, and I'm going to apologize for that, but it's the complicatedness of the subject that keeps it from being well known and scrutinized and critiqued. So there's nothing I can do about the fact that it's complicated. Okay, well, here's a statistic from Oxfam. The world's eight richest individuals own as much wealth as the poorest half of the world's population. In other words, eight people own as much wealth as 3.5 billion people. So how did we come to this strange and wrong state of affairs? After all, isn't money supposed to be something we get by doing something for someone else? Well, the answer to that question today is no. Money is conjured up out of nothing by banks for people who want to make a profit, and the same amount of money is erased again once that profit is taken. When money is created and destroyed in this way, it's hardly surprising that eight people have managed to grab so much. The process also creates debt at the same time, more of that later. Now, our money system was created for making war, which is robbery with violence made legal. For many centuries, war was considered glorious, and our banking system is a leftover from that time. It's a continuation of war by other means, and it's doing more damage today than ever before. We must reform it. And by the way, if anyone gets curious and a bit lost, there's printed out copies of my talk over there you can take away. But let's not blame it all on bankers. The truth is we are all embedded in a system which people are frightened to reform. Most people don't even want to think about it. Also, our money system is the main source of power in the modern world. So reform won't happen until ordinary people understand how it exploits them. And monstrous inventions like quantitative easing show how far existing powers will go to prop up and even to extend the system. How money is created today is no secret. You can read what I'm about to say on many central bank websites, but in more complicated language. But it's unfamiliar, so I'll try and describe it. Money itself is simple enough. We all know what money is. It's a kind of property. Mine is mine, yours is yours. We know what we use it for. We exchange it for things which are up for sale. In the past, money has been represented by many different things: shells, salt, gold, tobacco. Today, as we know, it's represented by notes, coins, and numbers in bank accounts. So, what makes these particular notes, coins, and numbers into money? The answer is pretty obvious: the law. Try phoning up a police station and complaining someone's stolen your Monopoly money. And it was new laws which allowed money to be conjured up by banks. About 300 years ago, the English Parliament, consisting of rich men voted in by other rich men, passed laws to say that debt could be bought and sold. In legal language, debt became negotiable. Debt could be bought and sold like a commodity, and the law would still insist that the debtor pay his debt to whoever happened to own it at the time. These laws changed the world. They gave a huge advantage to people with power and money, and I'll explain that. Any two of us could meet in the street and agree to owe each other £1 million. If we're two ordinary people, that's just a silly game. But if one of us is a powerful corporation, it is no longer a silly game. If the NatWest Bank owes me £1 million, for instance, I can buy a house off one of you and tell the NatWest Bank to owe you £1 million rather than me. And that is how money works today. Our money legally is debt from banks, what they call obligations in legal language. And our payments move what they owe us around from bank to bank to bank. Now, this gives two big advantages to those with wealth and power. First, wealthy and powerful people can conjure up money out of nothing by this process of summing up two equal and opposite debts. And secondly, we citizens end up paying interest on the entire money supply. Now, the conjuring trick of creating money is quite simple. Banks, and again, you can read this all on the Bank of England website if you want. Banks create money when they make a loan. When you borrow from a bank, it creates a debt from itself and a debt to itself from you. What you owe the bank is real enough. You have to pay interest on it and eventually pay it back. But the debt from the bank is a fake. What I mean by that is it doesn't need to pay anything but itself, because the law and regulations say that its debt is money. And this means that the bank can actually charge interest on its own debt. That's another reason why it's a fake, because it actually gets to charge interest on its own debt. In more honest days, this used to be called the magic trick of banking. Now it's less talked about, and it's also quite difficult to understand. Governments and banks profit together from the banking system, which is one reason why there's not much talk of reform. It's also why similar laws have been adopted by governments across the world. Socialist, communist, and fascist governments are no exception. They monopolize the system for the benefit of the party in charge. Right and left may disagree about many things, but they both want power. There is a much-quoted saying attributed to Henry Ford, among others, which goes something like this. It's well enough that people do not understand our banking and monetary system, because if they did, there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning. And that was said about 50 years, no, probably about, actually, probably about 8 years ago, I think. Anyway, so today, all our money is fake debt. The government supplies notes and coins, which are fake debt from the central bank. High street banks supply the numbers in our deposit accounts, which are also fake debt. Now, on this note here, this is a £10 note, and in tiny writing it says, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £10. Well, promise to pay is a debt. I am the bearer. So this is a debt from the chief cashier of the Bank of England, which it's signed. It's signed here by the chief cashier. Anyway, there's somebody called Andrew Bailey on the old notes, and I was just wondering, you know, if Andrew Bailey's here, maybe he can pay me what he's promising to pay me, you know? If he was, he would say, well, I'll give you, I'll swap it for another £10 note, or I'll give you two fivers. So that's the nature of debt, of money as debt. It's a fraud. So numbers in bank accounts are interchangeable with fake debt from the central bank. Fake debt from the central bank being notes and coins, numbers just being numbers. You can ask your bank to give you notes and coins in exchange for some of those numbers. But if too many people ask for notes and coins, the bank will go bust because they create a lot more numbers than they actually have in debt from the Bank of England. Their debts to each other, however, are real, the bank's debts to each other. I'm not going to go into how this system evolved, but it's very, very bizarre. And it's as complicated and fascinating as anything described by David Attenborough on one of his Nature programs. But I want to outline a few ways in which bank money and other kinds of fake debt are responsible for distress and damage in our world. Bank money doesn't cause the things I'm about to mention. They happen anyway. We live in that sort of world. But what bank money does is feed them and make them worse. Most obviously, for every bit of bank money, a corresponding amount of unnecessary debt is introduced. Who pays the interest? Ultimately, consumers. Who gets the interest? Shareholders. Inequality is enhanced. Money created for pure profit enables predatory speculators to buy up most of the world. Ownership becomes concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. In the end, we end up working for these predatory speculators. Human freedom, and of course their huge corporations, etc., human freedom and interdependency are replaced by management, exploitation, and dependence upon remote powers via these corporations. Now, because owners of industry naturally give out as little as possible in wages, it becomes harder and harder for wage earners to make ends meet, and they take on secondary debt. Now, growing inequality periodically seizes up the economy. Imagine a cafe with 100 customers. Supposing they've got £1,000 between them. If the money is evenly distributed, everyone buys a cup of coffee. If one of them has all the money in his pocket, only he can buy a cup of coffee. So soon the cafe owner's broke, like most of his customers. That's a simplified picture of economic paralysis due to inequality. Now, because bank money is generated from nothing and secretly, corrupt payments become easy. I'll just mention that each Russian kleptocrat happens to own his own bank. And now rich countries find it easy to buy up the assets of less developed nations, which is why large Western corporations buy up huge chunks of Africa and people get dispossessed, etc. Going to war becomes easy. The government doesn't have to say to its citizens, oh, we're raising taxes now so we can go to war. It just says to a bank, create some money and we'll get the taxpayers to pay you back. The same laws that enable bank money feed national debts. Large-scale national debts were born at the same time as those new laws. Savings are devalued by the vast amounts of money created by banks out of nothing. At the same time, vast amounts of debt are created, so interest rates go down to save the system from collapse. What happens then is that pensions, people's savings from a life's work, pay a pittance. The huge rise in house prices, for instance, is powered by bank money created for speculators. That bank money pushes prices higher and higher. Ordinary people find it hard. Luckily, I haven't got my glasses on.
1 minute to go.
Oh, no, I can't hear my right ear. So, at any rate, Okay, so other things I could only mention in passing, really, are unemployment, environmental damage, financial crises, and most of all, too much power going to overly ambitious and irresponsible people who are happy to ignore the destructive effects of what they do. Now, the crimes committed under this system are immense. Perhaps I better miss them out. So I want to go on to reform, and you better give me a minute and a half for this, because otherwise I'll have a tantrum. Okay, so how do we reform? Half measures, which consist of tightening the regulations, have been tried many times, but they've always been sidestepped by the finance and banking industries. The latest manifestation of this sidestepping is shadow banking, which a few years ago was creating more than £4,500 in value for every person on the planet. The figures are now no longer available. Apparently they're much higher, but they're oddly not available now. But luckily there is a simple way to reform the situation. Before the laws I mentioned were passed, debt was a private matter contracted between two people. Courts would help lenders get their money back, but they were reluctant to help debt that had been sold on and sold on and sold on to other people. So reform is actually just a simple matter of turning the clock back. And after it, money would still be simple property, but it would no longer be debt from a bank, nor would it automatically produce debt when it was created. There would still be borrowing and lending, there would still be inequality, there would still be shares and ownership. Notes, coins and digits would transfer to the new system, management and supervision would continue, but under a different authority, independent, just like the justice system is independent today. The essential task of reform will be legal, calling a halt to the robbery that feeds unaccountable war, environmental destruction, loss of freedom, and loss of moral agency. And then the greatest criminal enterprise ever invented will come to an end, and an era of peace, prosperity, and freedom might just possibly, while we are human, begin.
Thank you, Ivo. A very complex topic that I thought was very eloquently explained, and I hope that's opened some of our guests today's eyes over this very complex issue. The next speaker is going to talk about PFI, and she's obviously got a presentation to give. I read this very excellent booklet just as I was sort of registering people here this morning about the PFI initiative, private finance initiative, and I thought a statistic that was worthy of highlighting. So in 2017-2018, Lewisham will receive £91.1 million in council tax receipts. Out of that £91.1 million received in council tax receipts, £51 million, almost two-thirds, will be spent on paying PFI contracts. So I think that's something to bear in mind as we listen to Helen's talk.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much, and thank you for inviting me. Actually, I thought I was talking about nationalisation in more general terms, so that's what I'm mainly going to be talking about. Mike. I thought I was going to be talking about nationalisation in more general terms, so I'm going to be talking about that. So nationalisation, the N-word, as you could call it, has been in the news a lot recently, mainly thanks to the Labour Party conference, which, to the avowed horror of the CBI, asserted policies to turn the major utilities over to public ownership, and even, although they hedged their bets on this, to bring PFIs back in-house by nationalising the special purpose vehicles. Now, those of you who were here last year may remember my talk outlining the activities of these shell companies, these special purpose vehicles, who signed the PFI contract with the public body, another mechanism pumping private profits from our public services. And I put forward the view that to unravel these contracts, it was first necessary to nationalise these central companies. And you can find more account of how the whole process works at the exhibition over there. What I want to outline in the brief time I have is how the calls for public ownership now are responses to the perceived exploitation of various sorts, because the title of my talk is actually From Exploitation to Expropriation. And it hasn't come out very well. The colour hasn't come out.
We're just going to hit the light and then
go
see it.
Oh, OK. That's a shame. No, it's still black.
Oh, it's still black.
It's red on my screen. OK. OK, so it says, this is a quote from Warren Buffett, who's one of the key moneylenders in the world today. There's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. Basically, I'm using the term exploitation. Could you put the lights back on again? Sorry. So I'm using the term exploitation, not in a specifically Marxist sense, but as an online dictionary puts it. It's the act of treating someone unfairly in order to benefit from their work. It's taking advantage, it's bleeding dry, it's sucking, it's squeezing, it's swindling, it's fleecing, it's preying on. And I want to look at how all these ways in which we are being exploited work. Obviously, we're exploited as workers, and I just wanted to go back forward to the next slide, which shows, and the slides will be available, that the share of labour in the total GDP and total wages share has significantly decreased. It reached a high from between the 1940s to the 1970s, it reached a high, and since then, as a share of total incomes, it's decreased. So workers are getting an increasingly decreasing amount of the national cake. And, of course, the increasing inequality very much relates to this. A major aspect of the neoliberal programme was the attack on workers' rights and workers' ability to organise, anti-trade union laws, deregulation of the labour market and the free movement of labour. So all of these things have contributed to a situation of inequality and the exploitation of workers. But what I wanted to actually focus on more was our exploitation as other economic actors. Exploitation as consumers, the exploitation of suppliers by, for instance, the supermarkets, our exploitation as taxpayers through the tax havens, which mean there's an unequal burden there, exploitation of the environment, our exploitation of as debtors, and exploitation of public assets. And one increasing reason for growing inequality is the way in which private enterprise is now in a position to fleece not just workers, but most other economic actors. So I'm just going to point to a few examples. My first example is water. So I've got a little quote here. The quote is this. It seems to me absolutely certain that what Professor Simon called the power of life and death should not be in the hands of a commercial company, but should be entrusted only to the representatives of the people. I think the supply of water should not be directly or indirectly dependent on the profits of a private association. So I want you to put your hands up if you can guess who said that. Yeah? Anybody else? Karl Marx? Engels? No, it should not be in the hands of a private association. Margaret Thatcher would say it's not in the hands of a private association. No, these are the words of Joseph Chamberlain, who was a conservative unionist mayor of Birmingham in the 19th century. And by the middle of the 19th century, in the case of water, it was clear that with the growth of towns, private water companies, the supplies could not be guaranteed, and there was poor safety regulations. And in 1885, Joseph Chamberlain, a unionist conservative MP, mayor, municipalised not just water provision, but also the supply of gas, and he provided the first council houses. Other regions followed, and eventually the regional water boards came together in one nationalised industries. If we go forward 100 years, what have we got? Water is what's called a network industry. That is, you need a series of pipes in order to transport the commodity. So other examples of network industries are railways, where you need a network of rails, gas companies, where you need a network of pipes. All of those industries, it doesn't make sense to replicate the number of networks that there are. And so they tend to be monopolies. And they're called in economics natural monopolies. Now, when those natural monopolies get into private hands, you have a real problem. So the old regional nationalised water companies were given away to 10 regional private companies. And in 2016, the Public Accounts Committee reported that the water companies had made windfall profits of $1.2 billion by overcharging customers. The average household bill for water and sewerage increased 40%. And shareholder dividends in water companies, meanwhile, were running at 20 to 30% a year. And, of course, they don't pay tax if they can avoid it. The London company, Thames Water, was owned by an Australian company, Macquarie, who also owns the loads of PFI contracts. In 2013, it made £1.7 billion worth of profit, but then had the cheek to ask its 14 million customers to contribute additional money to cover its debts and infrastructure projects. Earlier this year, Macquarie sold its stake in Thames Water for up to £5 billion, and one of the buyers is the Kuwait Investment Authority, which is a state-run company. So that's the sort of ridiculous situation we have got into. And this, these things can be repeated in a load of different industries. So I've just got a few pictures there of gas, rail, where profits are being made. And I wanted to take another area where the exploitation is going on, and that's of debts and our assets, and that's PFI. Recent research shows that around 8% of all the money paid by the NHS for PFI, the unitary payments, leaves the NHS in the form of pre-tax profits. And for some of these contracts, the pre-tax profits represent 30% of the total amount of money paid by the public body. And that's not including the high interest rates of 10 to 15%. And what we have here are big monopoly companies tending to dominate the PFI market. So Veolia controls a half of all the PFI contracts in prison. Prisons are controlled by two main companies, an investment arm of Barclays and G4S. And because of this possibility that private provision will exploit consumers or the government, national ownership goes back a very long way. And I've just got a few examples here. Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries. OK, he then handed them back to his favourites, but he basically took them over. The royal arsenals, the royal dockyards were built under under the state. The post office was set up as a national monopoly designed to ensure that all parties could benefit equally from a network of coaches. And from the 19th century, under various sorts of government, conservative, Whig, Tory, liberal, what you want to call them, telegraph and telegraph system was gradually put under a state monopoly in the GPO. The Central Electricity Board was created in 1926 under a conservative government. And with railways, the first attempts were dated back from the 19th century. And in lots of ways, the Labour government of 45 was simply consolidating and bringing to a close a long process. At the municipal level, the use of public ownership is very widespread. Birmingham's water was municipalised. The London Passenger Transport Board, which is there, was created in the 1930s under a Conservative government. And, of course, during the Second World War, plenty of areas were requisitioned for war purposes for the public interest. I haven't got time to tell you how much, but just for a good example, 14.5 million acres of land was simply requisitioned. Helped us win the war. So nationalisation was historically a combination of evidence of profiteering and exploitation and the need to provide an efficient and comprehensive service. It was not a knee-jerk reaction, and it's not a knee-jerk reaction now. And the current response to consumer fears by the neoliberal elite currently is not to regulate better, but to try to artificially create competition. For instance, by providing consumers with more information like Uswitch or the open banking scam or disruptive technologies like Uber. But they are all pseudo-solutions which actually open up more opportunities for profiteering, for instance, in the case of Uber, with its exploitation of workers, or rather, self-employed drivers. So public ownership is a evidence-based solution to stop or prevent exploitation. It's totally accepted within mainstream economics. It's a historical tradition. If you view it historically, it's probably better associated with conservative or establishment parties than with the Labour Party. And public ownership is an evidence-based response, not a knee-jerk reaction. It is not the final solution to all our problems, but I would say that without bringing in public ownership over a broad swathe of what we do, and particularly in the utilities and PFI, we can't even begin to solve some of the problems that we have. It's the beginning and not the end.
Thank you, Helen. I thought that was a fantastic presentation. As we all know, the sort of political tide is turning when it comes to nationalisation. I've always found it very odd that nationalisation was such a dirty word, ever since the Thatcher period, really, and that all of a sudden we're now starting to get back to these sort of old ideas, which, as you say, were shared across the political divide, Conservative, Whig, Labour. It's not just a policy associated with the left. Sean, would you like to start your talk?
Thank you, everyone. I'm mindful that we're supposed to finish the session at 1:30, and we want time for discussion, so I'm going to try and...
We've got 15 extra minutes, so we'll finish at 45, quarter to
two. Oh, quarter to two, excellent.
You've got your normal 10 minutes.
Yay. Okay, right. And whoever's doing the timing, you're brilliant. Can you please do it at me a lot? That would be great. Because I have no concept of time at all. So, thank you for asking me to come and talk, and... I live just around the corner, but I work in Tower Hamlets mostly, and although I do work with local organisations like Ravi at the credit union, so it's really, really exciting to have a chance to come and kind of talk with residents and neighbours rather than what I do most of the time, which is to kind of go to places all around the country and talk to other people's communities about what they're doing. So just to be able to stand in my own London borough and to do this kind of chatting with people is just fantastic, so thank you. So I work in Toynbee Hall in the East End of London, and I spend all of my time trying to solve this problem, which is how do we sort out the problem that our money constantly gets devalued by the organisations with whom we do business, by like, who we transact. So some brilliant examples that have just already come out in other people's talking was around, you know, if I borrow some money from someone, let's say, you know, I want to invest in school, you know, uni fees, or to buy a car because I want to become a self-employed cleaner and I need to get my kind of equipment around the area, and therefore I invest in a car, or I invest in some study, or I invest in a qualification, or I invest in putting in plugs and stair gates in my home so I can become a childminder. All these things that Ravi described would be kind of good debt that are all about investment. But of course, actually, you know, there's all these other people on the other side of the equation who are going to lend to me, who are the lenders, and they're all going to take their profit. So there's that kind of issue of profit taking away my value of my money. And then there's when I buy my electricity, or if I buy my water, then there's all of the people on the other side of the equation who are selling me water or electricity and all the bills they've got to pay. But more importantly, the fact that they have also got to make a profit, and that's just brilliantly been brought out. You know, the fact that profit maximisation for someone other than us, other than our community, other than the people who are trying to live good lives, but the shareholders or the owners... That's where actually a firm's emphasis goes. It's not on how are we, it's not on how are we doing, it's not on is it a good society, it's not on are we developing well, it's not on what are the levels of peace and happiness and healthcare and essentially kind of doing well as a community or even as a nation. That's not where firms are required to put their intent, their focus, their efforts. Or so I thought, because we live in a country that has decided that what we will teach and what we will preach as the only economic model is neoliberalism. So, you know, I'm 48, and when I was at school, I learned about different economic models. I learned that there's such a thing as socialism. I learned that there's Marxism, I learned that there's capitalism, and I learned that there's a whole range of thinking about economics. But actually now, in 2017, on the school curriculum, what do you learn? You learn, crucially, a couple of key facts, which are that there's a price that we're willing to pay for something, and the moment when the price that I'm willing to pay as consumers and the price that someone is willing to charge as the provider, when those two lines intersect, you remember that graph in your economics about profit and price and hitting, and when these two lines intersect, when the majority of providers and the majority of consumers agree on a price, that's where the price fits. That's essentially neoliberal economics, and that is what we are talking about in this country most of the time. And so we've become a nation that fixates on the idea that firms must make a profit, that shareholder return on investment is what counts, and you've just heard there about what that does to healthcare, what that does to utilities, what that does to housing. We've probably been discussed in the previous session, I couldn't get here in time. And all about this emphasis that it's all about the shareholders and the managing director and the chief exec and the board, they're all returning investment for shareholders. Or so we believe. This is what we believe is people's obligation, their duty under regulations, under law. And I see it all the time when I'm working. And I talk to a firm, I talk to a manager, I talk to a chief exec, I talk to a board of trustees or a board of directors, and I say, why is it that your company does terrible things to people? And they'll say, well, because we have a duty. We have a duty to make the profit for the shareholders. And I think, gosh, what kind of world are we living in when I see lenders getting away with huge profits or debt collection companies getting away with terrible practice? So, is it true? No. It is not true that actually the driving duty for anyone working in business is profit maximisation. It's not the case at all. University professor at Cornell University in the US, Lynn Stout, wrote a fantastic book called The Shareholder Value Myth. Serving shareholders' best interests is not the same thing as either maximising profits or maximising shareholder value. Most investors care not only about their portfolios, but also about their jobs, their tax burdens, the products they buy and the air they breathe, which is to say, companies that maximise profits by firing employees, avoiding taxes, selling shoddy products, polluting the environment, can harm their shareholders more than helping them. I thought that was quite interesting. And then a Conservative MP, writing a couple of years ago, Jesse Norman, he wrote this. You must act in the way you consider in good faith would be most likely to promote the success of the company for the benefit of its members as a whole. Success will generally mean a long-term increase in value, but fundamentally it is up to each director to decide, in good faith, whether it is appropriate for the company to take a particular course of action. And they must consider the likely consequences of any decision in the long term, the interests of the company's employees, the need to foster the company's business relationships, the impact of the company's operations on the community and the environment, the desirability of the company maintaining a reputation for high standards, and the need to act fairly. So, company law does not say that companies must maximise profits, but that is what we teach in this country. It's what I'm given in the House of Lords on Tuesday night when I was arguing that that insurance companies are overcharging and blocking people from getting the insurance they need because they say that it's too expensive and they must maximise profits for shareholders. In the House of Lords, I was told that. I was told, as a fact, that those directors of those companies must maximise profits. It is not true. So we need two things. We need a public education process, including in schools, that sets right this myth that every firm's duty is to maximise profits. Actually, the firm's duty is much broader. And the second thing, I think, goes a little bit to some of the points already made, which is to reimagine how the community gets a voice in boardrooms. I don't know the answers to that, but I am interested to hear people's views. What I'm thinking about is the power that we see happening in the utility companies when a group of consumers, whether that's run through Martin's saving, money saving expert or some other bulk buying process, get people together to buy shares or to buy energy together in block group processes. But what, for example, if we joined together and became shareholders in the local companies or the companies that have a presence locally that are doing things that we don't like? And we start to use our shareholder vote to say, no, actually, profit maximisation is not the only decision that criteria that you need to use when making decisions in our community. What would that look like if we began to become active shareholders in those companies? And then if we started to replicate that more and more across communities in the country. Because I can have a lot of influence in my job nationally, but I feel like I have very little influence here in the local community. And I'm interested in how we together can have more influence. And this myth that it's about profit maximisation, by my own reading, it's so not. So what are we going to do? Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Well, I was educated probably a little time after you went to school, and we were taught a range of different ideas at my comprehensive anyway. I guess that was the same at most institutions. But we were told that ideas of Keynesianism and nationalisation were considered old-fashioned, and that we should only, you know, the only modern model for running the economy is a neoliberal one. But we were introduced to other ideas. But what I was interested by is how you ended your talk about what are the ideas for the future and how do we look forward to a positive vision where utilities can be in public ownership. That's probably going to be a likelihood over the next 10 to 15 years. So that might be an area to start the debate about the what type of structure of nationalisation can we adopt, because generally it is considered in the history literature that the old types of nationalisation were not terribly successful. The Labour government in 1945, it did nationalise, but it nationalised in the wrong way, because it tended to leave these organisations in situ, and it took much more painful reform decades later to get those industries working more effectively. Railways are a case in point, because they were nationalised as four separate companies and pretty much left to their own devices until the mid-1970s and into the 80s. Anyhow, we've got quite a long, about 20 minutes actually for questions. Obviously, we'll go on to the breakout room as well. Would anybody like to start off with a question? See hands in the air. Well, yeah, let's start with Phil over here. Yeah, you've just got to speak, yeah.
I thought it was a super panel, really very good stuff. But I just wanted to say to Sean, and it relates actually to what Helen was saying.
A bit closer to you. Yeah.
A bit closer?
Yeah.
Did you hear what I said before? Okay. I was saying how good the session was, but I wanted to relate what Sean said to perhaps what Helen was saying before that. Because you're quite right, of course, that it isn't required to maximise shareholder value. But the problem in a system of competition is, of course, that you need some very strong regulations to stop the people who are even more exploitative driving out those things. So, you know, perhaps something about how we might deal with that.
Well, I'd just like to add before I hand over to Sean is that often the government and local authorities have these powers already. The regulators have them, they just don't use them, and I would say it's a sort of lack of courage on their part. But Sean, if we pass over to you.
Oh, yes. So, is this on? Yeah. So, I absolutely agree with you, and I think this is one of the other myths of neoliberal economics, is that competition is always the means by which best outcomes are achieved. In my own work, I see that's utter rubbish. So, for example, one of the things I've been working on for the last 2 years is the fact that we know that for people on irregular or unreliable or unpredictable incomes, having to pay for your utility bills through direct debit is actually very harmful. And every time I've gone to the payment provider's banks and said, you know, all the data tells us that low income or self-employed or small businesses hate direct debits, and their response has always been, oh yeah, but there's no demand for something else. And I keep saying, the demand is huge, it's just not as profitable as direct debits. So I've worked with the regulator to create a space in which the firms and the industry and the payments industry have come together to create a new payment mechanism, but we needed the regulator to give the industry permission to switch off competition and switch on collaboration. And as a result, in a year's time, we'll have a new payment product called Request to Pay, which overcomes all those barriers. But it has been blood, sweat, and tears to get everyone signed up. And you're absolutely right. The idea that competition alone, in all circumstances, will achieve the best outcomes, we see again and again disproven. But it's one of those myths. And so I agree with you. I think that what I'm noticing now, particularly in the financial services sector, is that the regulator, particularly the FCA, is starting to be interested in the limitations of competition and to use its power. It can't change social policy, but it can use its power to explore where non-competitive solutions provide better outcomes.
Hmm. Yeah, Helen, do you want to, as a teacher, former teacher of economics?
Well, as an informed teacher of economics, all of the current economics textbooks, whether they're neoliberal or not, are pretty well out of date. I mean, I agree that profit maximisation per se is not the key motive for a company, but the only responsibility is to their shareholders. I mean, that is the only responsibility of a company, is to their shareholders. And that is clearly what you're trying to change. So you're trying to have a wider idea of stakeholders rather than just shareholders. And on the point of competition, yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, my point would be about it that we're in a position now where the competition is really pseudo-competition. There are so many specific sectors where a few companies, large companies, multinational companies, dominate the sector. And if they don't...
Should we give an example, Helen? Just thinking of energy. So we've got E.ON, EDF... Scottish Power, there's like four or five, aren't there?
Yeah, four or five, yes. With water companies, it's four or five. With, you know, as I was giving with PFIs. I mean, with supermarkets, four or five big
Tesco,
retailers.
Tesco, Sainsbury's, yeah.
Tesco, Sainsbury's, yeah, Asda, Morrison. If you add in Aldi and Lidl, it comes to, if you add just those six, they dominate about 90-odd percent of total grocery till roll. And, of course, with that monopoly, they're able to squeeze their suppliers. So that's where you see British farmers suffering so badly. And once they're in that position, they can form cartels, they can form gentlemen's agreements, they can have little chats here and there, they can go and lobby the government. And I think that the whole idea of competition has just become not just a myth, it's a pseudo competition that's going on.
It's very close linked to our political model though, isn't it, where lobbying is so easy, where firms are able to spend a lot of money lavishing politicians who are probably quite easily persuaded. And that's on both sides of the political divide. I don't think this is not just an issue with the right. Mina, just at the front down here.
Thank you. Two questions. Well, one around cryptocurrency and how that is going to challenge some of the ideas around banks and their control of money and production of money. And also the Labour Party idea about investment bank and how that might begin to change things. I take big issue with Ravi.
So did you have a question there?
Yeah, I want to challenge what you said about debt. There are teachers and nurses who are using food banks. People are being forced into debt, and the choosing between food and heating is not about luxury, it's not about indulgence. People who use child benefit, many of them need that money because they need it to
survive. Is there a question though, Amina?
Just so I think what you said does not represent what's happening today. So I don't know where you got your data from, but what you, I think you're... Are you excluding millions of people who are not able to have any money and in debt?
So what, are you saying that people need debt to be able to survive?
No,
is that what you mean?
They're
forced into it.
We've had a drop in real wages since the Napoleonic times.
Yeah. So you're criticising his view.
Yeah, I'm criticising that model.
That you shouldn't pretend you can't have debt.
I'm saying that the fact is that real wages have fallen in real terms since Napoleonic times. People are struggling. And to say people are getting in personal debt because of luxury or addiction does not deal with what really is happening today, in my view.
Just very quickly, Ravi.
I did say before I started to speak that systemic issues I'm not going to deal with. So low wages and, you know, people are expensive rent, I can't deal with.
You so, did? Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I think the gentleman next to you had a question. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I'd just like to say, sort of, it's really sort of a pleasure listening to all the team and all the ideas, and everything you said is true. But the main problem we face in our society is usury. And the only way we're going to get usury, and I can still listen to all of you, listen to what Sean has said, is to have in local communities, having shares and that sort of thing. But the thing is, how are we going to implement that? This is the key problem. And I'd like to see any ideas that you can come up with, how we can implement what you said and the process so that we can stop usury from keeping us in debt.
Oh, you want an answer?
Yeah. No, I'll just take one more question back. Just a very quick response. Just what one pressing question at the back, just quickly.
Okay, so number one, there's a credit union. And the credit union is both a local community lending bank. No money can flow out of the credit union to non-members. So any interest charged on lending from a credit union is always circulated back into the credit union for re-lending to members. So the simplest, quickest answer we have as a community to tackling usury is to become members of the credit union, to borrow from the credit union when we need to borrow. So, for example, I am doing up a house, I need to borrow some money. One of the things that I need to do is to borrow not from a bank or a credit card, but to borrow from the credit union, because then when I pay interest on that credit union, it increases the credit union's money for onward lending to that teacher who needs to borrow at a low interest, capped at 3% maximum per month. Plus, the credit union needs to not fall into the trap of becoming like other lenders and thinking it's all about profit maximisation. And so I'm working with Ravi and his team in part of my day job on looking at how does the credit union become the best possible option for local people, both to borrow from and to save with and for other products and services. So for anyone who's interested in tackling the usury problem where it is about financial transactions, because obviously usury comes in many forms, but the quickest answer I've got is about the credit union, is join the credit union.
That's great. We're going to have to stop there, I'm afraid, and continue the discussion in the breakout room. But thank you for the questions, and thank you for the time for the panellists. Of course, join us if you want to continue the debate in the breakout room.